Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, exploring world's past, we go to the Vatican Museums to catch a glimpse of Rome's early Christian heritage and its underground treasures. Plus, we'll hear about a Renaissance Pope's recently restored secret rooms. And we begin a Lenten series of reflections on the places we Christians hold dear in the land of Christ's birth. Hundreds of miles of catacombs lie beneath the consular roads going in and out of the city of Rome. Roads like the Appian Way, the Aurelia, the Triumphale, and the Via Cassia. It was in these underground, honeycombed burial chambers that early Christians were laid to rest in an imperial Rome where they were often persecuted for their faith. Like their pagan companions, early Christians were often buried with objects bearing symbols attesting to their faith. As part of their 500th anniversary celebrations for 2006, the Vatican Museums recently refurbished the Christian Museum, which contains many of the artifacts found in excavations of the catacombs. I took a tour of the museum, which is found in what used to be the Papal Library, but what is now a wing of the Vatican Museums. Starting with the early Christian findings in the Christian Museum, visitors can begin what I'd call a historical and artistic pilgrimage throughout the ages of Christianity. Proceeding down what seems to be like miles of corridor, they can view medieval, Renaissance, and Baroque objects of Christian devotion too. This pilgrimage, which leads all the way to the Sistine Chapel, takes visitors past the Santo Santorum, a collection of highly ornate boxes and caskets that once contained some of the Church's most prized relics from Jesus' Passion, the cross and crown of thorns, and other relics. They have since been returned in new containers to their resting place at the Holy Stairs at the Basilica of St. John Lateran across the Tiber River. My guide on my own tour was decorative arts curator Guido Cornini. I wanted to know if the Christian Museum, in effect, is the first leg of a pilgrimage that culminates in Michelangelo's spectacular Sistine Chapel.
Actually, it's to be found on the way back from the Sistine Chapel, because here, this very part of the Vatican Museums is placed along a corridor which links the Sistine Chapel with the exit, actually. So people unexpectedly find this lots of findings and archaeological, mostly exhibits, when going out of the Sistine Chapel and prepared to cross those who once were the Vatican Libraries section. As a matter of fact, this collection was gathered by the Vatican Library at the mid of the 18th century by Pope Benedict XIV, Lambertini, very well known for his promotion of culture in general. He was the one who had the idea of opening a museum, and for the time it was a very modern thinking, focused on early Christian archaeology. That means on the archaeological finds which were found in the catacombs, the most famous Roman cemeteries, developing underground for kilometers and kilometers, and which were the burial place for many generations of Christians in the early centuries of our age.
The array of objects left me spellbound. Exotic fish and sea creatures bursting out of glass lanterns, hand-carved ivory figures and faces, silver dishes designed with the signs of the early Christian faith.
Little gems or glasses or stones of different kinds, engraved stones, I mean, and more, and oil lamps. And all are, in some cases, moving, in some cases, just historically meaningful witnesses of their own period, of a period in which these Christians were not so much different from their contemporary pagan fellows, and in which the only thing which distinguished ones from the others was their strong faith in a different perspective in life and in the hereafter as well. And therefore, it's not unusual to find members of the same family professing different beliefs. And even in the case of a certain Christian faithful, there's some confusion, what we might regard as some sort of theological confusion in their linearity and consistency of expression of faith.
Now, I see a lot of people walking by here, and few of them are stopping to actually look at what is in these beautifully ornate cabinets. After you've seen the Sistine Chapel, maybe this might seem a bit dull to people. What is not dull about it? What should grab their attention?
Well, of course, it's not an exhibition of art in the most traditional sense. Again, being archaeological documents, they should be understood more as a witness to their own times. So we're not dealing with something which is beautiful, which can appeal to people passing so exhausted after they're queuing up before entering the Vatican museums, and then inside the galleries themselves, and finally until they reach their final aim, which is the Sistine Chapel itself. Once out, I can believe they are so tired, and maybe they're not so willing to stop by and to reflect. But this is it. This was thought, as a matter of fact, as a room which was part of the Vatican Library. So before it came to be musealized, so to speak, this room was accessible from the other part. And in fact, the front of the room is ornate, and the architectural setting looks on the northern part of the corridor. Because scholars were supposed to pass from the reading room to the musealized part of the library, housing these particular collections. And it was meant as a visit in itself, not something which is nowadays included in these mass touristic tours for people coming from all over the world, which in one day have to secure all Roman highlights, including the Sistine Chapel. It's craftsmanship, is the work of humble hands working on such everyday objects like oil lamps, for instance. They may be in clay or in bronze or in beautifully ornated glasses, maybe engraved or decorated with golden leaf, or even rings, or even devotional medals to wear upon their own clothes. I mean, all the kind of things you wouldn't expect connected with the world of fine arts, but more on the level of anthropological meaning.
But there certainly are some absolutely extraordinarily beautiful things here.
Oh, yes, also, particularly the golden glasses. We may take a look in the other window. They were the bottom of actual bowls or vases of some sort, which used to be decorated with a golden leaf, which was partially engraved, and with this graffiti technique, you could get figures out of that, or ornamental patterns in general. And in the end, the golden leaf stratum came to be trapped between two layers of glass. They were put together in a furnace of some sort, and the final result was to have these beautiful and luxurious decorations, meant not certainly for the humblest layers of society, but for richer society.
Explain what we're seeing here. These are the bottoms of goblets or plates, glassware.
Exactly. They were broken purposely when the deceased came to be buried, because this sort of marks were put inside the plaster of the loculum, of the actual burial site.
The catacombs were made up of miles of underground galleries cut out into rows of rectangular niches called loculi, of various dimensions where the bodies of the dead were laid to rest. Decorations such as these gold-leaf glass designs, placed on the outside of a burial chamber, would help relatives locate their deceased family members.
C'è in fisso una statuina con un piccolo amorino. Un amorino, guardate, con una fiaccola rovesciata, era il simbolo della morte, no? La fiaccola che veniva spenta. È un simbolo pagano.
Curator Umberto Utro literally bubbles over with enthusiasm, talking about how early Christians used much of the same iconography as their pagan counterparts, but proudly displayed their Christian heritage. Utro was talking about beautiful marble reliefs, silver dishes and terracotta oil lamps used in everyday life, but the designs were Christian. Today, he said, you wouldn't be able to find fish and loaves of bread embroidered on a Valentino or a Gucci dress or handbag, but Rome's early Christians wore such emblems with pride. Curator Cordini agrees.
To show somebody's personal beliefs was not something attaining to the private sphere of personality. It was something which was made in the public, particularly from the 4th century onwards, when so-called peace of the church, Constantine recognized Christian religion as the official empire religion, and therefore the glory of the altars, so to say, was open to them. Yes, it was possible to use religious motifs, let's say, as decoration patterns.
One of the concepts I found particularly interesting is how Christian belief was interpreted in artwork by early Christians. Rather than cremate the dead, as many Roman pagans did, early Christians looked forward to a reawakening. The catacombs were laid out like sleeping chambers, places of rest on an ongoing journey. In the exhibit, too, visitors will see early crosses bearing the Greek symbols for Alpha and Omega, Christ as the beginning and the end. But in a few cases, you'll see the symbols switched, the Omega before the Alpha, as if to underline the belief that life actually begins after death.
You're underlying the sense of eternity by preposing the Omega rather than the Alpha as the historical beginning of every single individual life.
But not just eternity, but the beginning of life after death.
Yes, in similar senses, in the early Christians speak of the death day as a Dies Natalis, as you may know, which is the birthday, the real birthday of somebody's to the real life, which is the eternal life which expects us after death. Of course, for a lay approach, this is nonsense. For a Christian approach, this is the difference.
For early Christians, it was a different, concept that life begins after death, from the pagan concept.
Of course. Even if they both shared some kind of very physical approach to the idea of burial, because both of them, I mean the two groups, pagans and Christians, would surround the deceased with things which used to be like his personal favorite objects in life, so to say. Typically, talking about a child, toys. We have the number of little dolls, for instance, in ivory or in wood, which were meant as...
As part of this exhibit?
Not here particularly, but they were found and they're exhibited elsewhere, but not particularly here. But for the same reason you find rings, for instance, or golden glasses or personal objects, which again were put in the plaster of the burials to make them recognizable.
Were any of these objects found in the necropolis and the Christian catacombs underneath St. Peter's?
No, because when this particular museum was founded back in the 1757, the necropolis underneath St. Peter's was not yet discovered, of course. That is a recent discovery dating to the 40s of the last century, during the World War II particularly. The archaeological excavations culminated in the positive identification of St. Peter's tomb, but all the necropolis around was a mixed situation of pagan and Christian burials, but none of them provided material for this particular exhibition, which is centered on the exhibits already put to light in the time of Benedict the 14th.
And a very warm thanks there to my guide on that tour of the Christian Museum, Guido Cornini, curator for the Decorative Arts Department of the Vatican Museums. It took 4 years to restore, but only 2 to paint. Pinturicchio's 15th century paintings in the Borgia apartments, in what used to be Pope Alexander VI's private rooms, and what are now comprised in the Vatican Museums.
We can now enjoy again the environment as such where Pope Alexander VI received visitors.
Vatican Museums curator Arnold Nesselrath explains the extensive restoration project was part of the 500th anniversary celebrations of the museums for 2006. Only 1 of 5 rooms was restored, though. The Room of the Mysteries of the Faith, where the Italian Renaissance artist and his team portrayed in splendidly rich colors scenes from the Annunciation, the Nativity, the Adoration of the Magi, the Pentecost, the Assumption of the Virgin and Christ's resurrection.
Il Pinturicchio, perché era affiancato da tanti allievi e perché doveva eseguire la decorazione della.
Director of the Vatican Museums, Francesco Buranelli, says restorers discovered Pinturicchio's team of artists used a revolutionary form of wall painting for the time, using fast-drying tempera rather than the traditional al fresco technique, which required more time for preparation and fixing.
Non dipinse in affresco, bensì stese una doppia mano di colle.
But, as Buranelli explains, that meant the paintings were more subject to deterioration with time. The 4 remaining rooms in the Borgia apartments are part of a second phase of restoration over the next few years. As we begin the Lenten season, we present a series of reflections each Friday with Father Peter Stravinskas, a noted scholar, author, and apologist. He is founder of the Priestly Society of the Venerable Cardinal John Henry Newman and editor of the Catholic Response. Each week, Father Stravinskas takes me and our listeners on a tour of the holy places where Jesus and his family walked and lived in the Holy Land. Today, he begins with a reflection on the holy town of Nazareth in Galilee, in modern-day Israel. This was the village where the Virgin Mary and later the Holy Family lived. Pilgrims visiting Nazareth today can pray at the Basilica of the Annunciation, which was built over the cave which Mary had made her home, and where it is believed the angel Gabriel came to her, announcing that God had chosen her to bear the Messiah.
The message of salvation is literally incarnated in our history, and God chooses to work with and through history to continue to reveal himself. And here we see the Virgin of Nazareth cooperating with God's plan. And from that very moment forward, as the New Testament really begins, we find that God chooses to limit himself to human responses. Our Lady very easily could have said, no, forget about it. I've got to get my hair done today. It's not going to work. But as a matter of fact, she cooperates with the Father's plan. And as a result, the greatest event in human history takes place. God is able to enter into our affairs. This is something that is really the root of the so-called sacramental principle as well, that God then uses throughout salvation history very human means to achieve our salvation, as the fathers of the church were fond of talking about the flesh as the hinge of salvation, caro cardo salutis, so that God uses these created realities and our human effort in union with his grace to bring about the salvation. St. Augustine says, the God who created you without you will not justify you without you. We have to participate in the process, and Our Lady and Nazareth stand to me as very strong reminders of that reality.
Many months after Mary said yes to the Lord in Nazareth, she and Joseph traveled south to Bethlehem to register for the census of the population ordered by the Emperor Augustus. It was here in the small village, surrounded by olive groves and fields where shepherds tended their flocks, that Mary gave birth to the Christ child. Over the centuries, bit by bit, a massive stone basilica has been built up over the humble stable, the cave where he was born. Today, pilgrims to the Basilica of the Nativity can make their way through a series of Orthodox chapels to arrive at a set of narrow steps that lead down to the grotto. A burnished bronze star marks the place where Jesus once laid his head. Though the basilica remains the focal point of Bethlehem, today, part of the Palestinian territories, many local Christians have fled the violence and the economic hardships to live abroad. Countless souvenir shops, hotels, and restaurants, for many people their only source of income, are closed or open just a few hours a day. Pilgrims and tourists have been slow to return to Bethlehem since the last Intifada erupted. But how should we reflect on Christ's birth in Bethlehem this Lent? Despite all the hardships facing the small Christian community, indeed all Palestinians living there, shouldn't it be Christmas in Bethlehem every day of the year?
Of course, Christmas ought to be every day in the heart of every Christian. When we think about Bethlehem, one of the first things that strikes me is the fact that St. Jerome, who gives us the great line that ignorance of the scriptures is ignorance of Christ, was so intent on getting it all right that he himself went to the Holy Land before embarking on his project of translating the scriptures into Latin, the famous Latin Vulgate. And he went and lived in a cave in Bethlehem. And interestingly enough, he gives us a fascinating expression. He refers to the Holy Land itself as the fifth gospel, because simply by being there, one breathes in everything that brings us the message of salvation. And when you go to the Church of the Nativity, there's also the grotto of St. Jerome, where he lived in a cave. And also interesting, Jerome was so intent on getting it right with the language that he hired a rabbi to teach him Hebrew. So he got it directly from the direct source. But in the Church of the Nativity itself, and I'm always very partial to the Feast of Christmas because it happens to be my birthday as well. But in order to get into that church, you have to bend down, and it's called the Door of Humility.
It's a very small door.
Yes. Well, of course, there was a practical reason, as you undoubtedly know, was to keep out the animals and keep out the invaders. But there's also a profound theological message to that. One has to bow down in order to appreciate the mystery of the Incarnation. This is not something that just comes automatically. One can't sit down and come up with a mathematical scientific formula to say, of course this all makes perfect sense. In a very real sense, it doesn't make sense. And it's interesting that just as there's the door of humility to get into the Church of the Nativity, there's also the need to bow down to get into the tomb of Christ. In order to understand, even in our limited human way, the mystery of the resurrection, one also needs the virtue of humility.
In the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
In the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Mm-hmm. At the two endpoints, really, we could say, of our Lord's earthly existence, his birth in Bethlehem and his resurrection in Jerusalem, in order for us today to get into physically those sites, we have to adopt the mentality of humility. in order to appreciate that. And I'm always reminded when thinking about Christmas, some of the tremendous insights that Archbishop Fulton Sheen had in this regard. And he said, it's interesting that at Bethlehem, it's only the very wise or the very humble that have access to the Christ child, the shepherds and the magi. And he says, and Christ seems always to appeal to either of those two groups, and people stuck in the middle who are self-important, who are arrogant. The mark of a truly wise man is that he knows that he doesn't know an awful lot. And the poor shepherds, they knew that they were ignorant. And to those two groups, the angels are able to give the message of salvation, and they're able to receive it. And therefore, for us to receive, to accept the meaning of the mystery of the Incarnation, we too have to adopt this attitude that we don't know everything. And modern man is so proud of all his great accomplishments, but at the same time, if we look at the history, for example, of the century that we just left, the bloodiest century in history, and yet with the greatest technological advances, and we have to understand, of course, it's the first century in history which attempted to go it formally, institutionally, without God. We can laugh at the Greek gods and the Roman gods and the Egyptian gods and all the rest of it, and joke about their naivete, that they thought these were great things. But the truth of the matter is they had that basic human instinct that there was a dimension beyond themselves and that they were answerable to someone or something beyond themselves. The mark of the 20th century was precisely the opposite. It was man was the center of everything, and when that happens, of course, there's ironically, a complete dehumanization. If we enter into the mystery of the Incarnation, and as we say in every Mass, as the priest mingles the water and the wine, may we come to share in the divinity of Christ, who humbled himself to share in our humanity. His humility gives us access to his divinity, and it's only by doing it his way that we're able to achieve the greatest humanization, which is taking on his sacred humanity and bringing ourselves into communication with that.
You said that Christmas should be celebrated every day in our hearts as Christians.
We Catholics, as a matter of fact, experience Christmas every day, every time we celebrate the Eucharist, because God once again takes flesh in the celebration of the Holy Eucharist. And so many Catholics are completely oblivious to that mystery, that as a matter of fact, the Mass is the continuation of the mystery of the Incarnation. And the Church is always very careful about that. So, for example, the Church tells priests that without strong pastoral necessity, a priest is not to celebrate Mass more than once a day, because familiarity breeds contempt. So we can get so used to this that we say, oh, sure, yeah, well, God became man. Yeah, well, we know that. Well, we should be struck by that. It's just such an astonishing concept, and it takes a quantum leap of faith in order to appreciate that, to appropriate that truth.
Father Peter Stravinskas is a noted scholar, author, and apologist. He is editor of The Catholic Response. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.